This is a No Dumma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I'm joined by Doc Norton, a former code slinger turned process and leadership coach. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening to join me, Doc.
Yeah, absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you.
So to start off, can you tell me a little bit about your background, please?
Yeah, sure. So you mentioned in the intro that I'm a former code slinger. That's true. I've been in the industry for about 30 years, at least professionally, a little longer than that as a hobbyist. And I started off as a developer, writing code in any number of languages that nobody uses anymore. And you know, advanced through to C and C++ and C Sharp and Java and all that. But what I kept finding over and over again was that no matter how good the team was from a technical perspective, from a process perspective, the challenges they faced were often broader than that, outside of the team, whether it was leadership or the organization itself. And so, so I have now more of a process and leadership coach. I've kind of changed my focus to where I'm looking at how do we structure organizations, how do we build systems that enable teams to deliver even better.
Do you go into companies or do you kind of consult remotely with them?
It's a little bit of both. So oftentimes, certainly going in to help do assessments and understand where they actually are. And then sometimes the coaching is actually on the ground where I'm, almost embedded with teams or with leaders. And then I have clients where, we meet once a month, once a quarter, and it's, just a video call, and we kind of catch up on where are they, what are the problems they're facing, and I may point them in a particular direction or, help them think through a problem.
More recently, you've written a book titled Escape Velocity, Better Metrics for Agile Teams. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk a lot about the book for the rest of the podcast, but just first, why did you decide to write it?
That's interesting. I was actually writing a book on organizational designs and decision-making protocols and those types of things. And while I was doing that, I was really struggling with the writing. And I reached out to a few friends, and Johanna Rothman was one of them. Johanna was really generous with her time, always has been, and took maybe an hour to chat with me. And she said, I totally get the problem. Sometimes what we need to do is rather than try and write a thing, just write. And so I tried that. I tried just writing something every single day. And I had a client that I had done a couple of workshops for around metrics, and they'd asked me for some additional information. And I started writing them a white paper that was going to be a few pages long. I was 8 pages into it and realized, man, I have a lot more to say. And I was 16 pages into it and realized, I better wrap this up and finish it for the client, but there's something here. And decided that I'm just going to keep writing on that until I don't feel like I can anymore. And now it's 115 pages long, and I've got maybe 2 more chapters to go, 30-some thousand words. So I seem to have landed on a topic where the writing came easy.
But even though you have a couple of chapters to go, it is published and available, I think.
It is, yes. It's on LeanPub, which has been actually fantastic to use because it's provided me an opportunity to get some rough ideas out there and get feedback from a community. And it's actually – publishing early has helped to shape the book and I think continues to do so.
I had a guest on a few weeks ago, Laurence Bozzavi. He's also using LeanPub to publish his book about the myths of software development.
Yes.
I'll provide a link to your book, of course, in the podcast notes. But we're going to turn maybe just to the general topic now for the rest of the podcast, as you covered in your book, is velocity and agile. So to start off, what is velocity?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting. Most folks who have attempted some agile implementation have probably heard of velocity. Fundamentally, when it gets right down to it, it is a measure of units of work over some period of time, which actually is speed, right? Velocity has to be a vector, right? So I tend to say it is the rate at which a team delivers value to the customer. So if you're not moving towards value, then it's not velocity. And I think folks that have attempted various forms of agile implementations have probably also figured out that it's a really squidgy measure. It's hard to figure out what it's actually telling you. And in many cases, it's hard to figure out what to do with that data. In my opinion, velocity is probably one of the most common metrics in among agile teams, and one of the most useless out there. And that was really part of the onus of the book was, you know, we need to start thinking in a different way about how we actually measure our teams and determine it's not success.
How is it measured? What are the common ways of measuring it?
So I tend to refer to it as just units of work over a period of time. It's fun, you know, if you measure your work in terms of how much work is this in ideal days or person hours or points or whatever, and then you're delivering at some cadence, be that every month, every 2 weeks, every week, and whatever that might be, you're basically taking the number of units that you deliver in that period of time. So if you've got a 2 week iteration and you estimate in story points for whatever reason you might do that. And you know, last iteration you finished 20 story points, then your velocity is 20. And so theoretically you're going to use that as some kind of a measure. You're going to say, well, if our velocity was 20 and there's 400 points left, then it's going to take us 20 iterations or 40 weeks to get all of this work completed. And that's the theory, and that's the idea behind it.
Okay, so I've heard that and I've seen that done, but you've made the comment, and I'm paraphrasing you, it's hard to measure and then you can't do anything with it. So I'm assuming you're going to say that that estimation is going to take 40 iterations or 20 iterations or whatever it happens to be, doesn't really work out very often.
It's usually bunk. Yeah. And for a number of reasons, right? One of them is that typically with velocity, even if we don't intend to, we are still trying to, one, the unit of measure is a guess of time required to complete a thing. And when we were writing accounting systems, filing systems, docketing systems for, you know, law firms, when we were writing those types of systems and we knew step by step, piece by piece, procedure by procedure, what everything was supposed to be, we had a shot at maybe being able to guesstimate how long it was going to take, right? And so these kind of coarse grain estimates and measures could serve us fairly well. Today's software development is not automating manual processes. Even if it is, what we're doing is we are inventing new process. We are creating new things all of the time. And that creation process is fundamentally unpredictable. It's very, very difficult for us to determine how long is a thing going to take, no matter how much we try and break it down beforehand. So the unit that we're using is not very reliable, in and of itself, right? And then most teams, especially when they start out, but even I've seen teams that have been together for a long time, where there are so many systemic problems that create long delays and wait and all kinds of other issues, that velocity is consistently unpredictable. Last iteration it was 20. This iteration we're targeting 10. Two iterations ago it was 104. And why? So it's not a very good, a very reliable measure. And many, many teams that I see trying to use it just end up getting super frustrated. Begin to see behaviors where teams. Velocity will stabilize, but not because delivery got any more stable, because the team has collectively figured out how to deliver estimates and whatever else they need to do to make velocity look the way it's supposed to look. So we've not solved any problems here other than velocity didn't look the way it was supposed to. And we've now collectively figured out how to kind of push that into the background. All of our problems still exist, but velocity looks good.
So who's pushing this measure? Because in my experience, it's not software engineers.
No, it doesn't tend to be. It is certainly, you know, I'm doing air quotes, which of course the users can't see, but it's the business, right? And I say that, you know, kind of very tongue in cheek, because it can be that we have made a promise to the market that we are going to get a thing done by a certain date. And so now we've got pressure to make sure that it's done, and we need to be able to measure something to tell us, are we on target? Is it actually possible? It might be that, hey, we're doing Agile, and I read the book, and the book says that you estimate in this way, and you use the velocity, and so that's what I'm going to start doing. And you know, so it may be any number of reasons that it's kind of being being pushed. I think most often these days when I see it in organizations, it's because we're Agile, and this is what we're supposed to do.
Why do you think it is that they buy into that one aspect of Agile? There's a ton of different things. There's a friend of mine, Jeff Glennon, who used to be an Agile coach. He's left the industry now. But his approach was to go into a company and say, all right, from developer to CEO, everyone has to buy in that things are unpredictable, things can change, things are hard. But we expect from the business kind of in on-time stories with detailed requirements. And in return, we'll deliver you something in approximately 2 or 3 weeks. But what ends up happening instead is we need something by the end of September. We're not sure what it is, but we need it. So they buy into the idea of not having to give detailed end-to-end specs. Mm-hmm. And they buy into the idea of wanting a velocity so that they can estimate. But the rest of that other stuff that might be of use, yeah, out the door. Forget about it.
Out the door, right. Yeah, and I honestly don't know why this is, other than it seems to me that in many organizations, we have an entrenched perspective, right? And we have systems in place that have kind of established a particular standard or norm. And when we look at a lot of organizations and we say, okay, we're going to change the way we're doing things around here. I've read about this new approach to software development, and it doesn't have to be Scrum or XP or Crystal or you know, whatever, DSDM, whatever, right? Some flavor of agility. Typically what ends up happening is our mental frame stays the same. And what we see is a smorgasbord of tools to choose from, that we will use these tools. They will make things better, but our general mental frame stays exactly the same. So we're not moving into experimentation, adaptability, ability to actually respond to change, creating. We're stuck with this notion of fixed scope by a deadline, and then we choose a handful of the available practices that sound good and apply those. And it's, you know, we're not many in many cases. We're not making a fundamental change to the way that we think about and execute the work.
I also get the feeling there's an element of a lack of trust sometimes from, again, to use air quotes, the business. I was at a product camp a few months back in Boston, and there was a lot of very bizarre opinions being foisted on the audience by people. But one of them was a trick you can use to get developers to work harder. It's tell them you're going to draft in another developer onto the project. And it's kind of, you don't need tricks. But the impression I got, not just from that, was there's a feeling that we as developers sit there and we think, we say things are hard, and then we somehow deliver them on time. And they forget that that somehow often means cutting corners or working overtime.
Yep.
And therefore, oh, you must have lied to me to say it would take more than a sprint. So have you seen the same sort of thing, this lack of trust?
Yeah, across the organization, right? Both, not just that you know, we say the business doesn't trust developers, but developers don't trust the business. And I think a lot of this is a result of systems and procedures and ways that we interact that reinforce separation, silos, you know, that accountability is actually misplaced instead of, you know, in places where it should be shared, it's not. And it just reinforces these ideas of us versus them. So, yeah, I think that some of the reasons are, you know, a lack of trust in an environment.
Another thing I've kind of wondered about is the biggest part of software, I think I've said this in other podcasts, is people. There are people involved in requirements. There are people developing. There are people deploying. There are people using. And then, of course, we have our complexity of our code, our databases, our web services, our networks, our other interactions. And the idea of somehow bringing all that incredible complexity down to a crude single or double-digit number seems almost impossible to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so, you know, can we talk a little bit about this? So you're talking about, again, it's difficult to estimate how long a thing would take, right, or what the effort is, right? One of my favorite analogies there, because I think fundamentally what we're doing with software development is we're solving problems, right? That's what developers are actually doing, is they're solving problems. The hands-on keys, the actual, you know, code slinging part is, you know, it's very similar to kind of the carpentry involved in, you know, making a fine piece of furniture. There's so much more involved before you actually shave that edge, right? There's so much more involved before you actually, you know, write that line of code. So if we're fundamentally solving problems, one analogy that I use is Sudoku puzzles, right? Most folks are familiar with those these days, and many of us have probably seen a book of Sudoku puzzles that we've, you know, picked up at the store, or, you know, maybe your grandma's got one in the bathroom. I don't know. But those books are usually broken down into easy, medium, and difficult puzzles, right? And you know that on average, because you do these a lot, so you know that on average an easy puzzle takes you 5 minutes, a medium puzzle takes you 8, and a hard puzzle takes you 12, right? That's how fast you can normally solve a Sudoku puzzle of that rating, okay? So then analogously, I ask you about different software problems, and you use a scale of, you know, 3, 5, and 8 to say it's easy, it's medium, it's hard, right? Now, if you pick up an easy puzzle, normally taking you an average of 5 minutes to solve, and it takes you 17 minutes to solve it, was it a hard puzzle?
I don't know.
The answer is no. It was an easy puzzle. You had difficulty, right? You missed an inference. Something. There was something in there that you didn't see that made it difficult for you. Maybe you did. Maybe you answered one of the squares wrong and that threw you off. Maybe, you know, any number of things might have happened. But the reality of it is that was still an easy puzzle. And you know, so when we estimate in complexity, which I think is a reasonable thing to try and do, better than trying to estimate in time, part of the challenges we have is if the work effort falls outside of our average, we freak out and we try and get better at estimating when, wait, maybe you're perfectly fine at estimating. In fact, maybe that variance falls within, you know, 2 standard deviations and is perfectly acceptable. But we don't look at that. We just freak out. And that's when we start gaming velocity numbers even more.
In your book, you've identified a bunch of anti-patterns that you've come across over time. Could you go through a few of those for me, please?
Yeah, sure. So these are all velocity anti-patterns, and they're basically behaviors that I see come about when, you know, we start measuring and then kind of abusing velocity, right? So one of the most common ones is this demand for higher velocity, this expectation. And part of it is that, you know, if we read some of the Agile books, there's this magic period where velocity will stabilize and increase. No one explains how or why it happens, just that it's supposed to happen. And so we start actually creating pressure on teams to deliver faster, to increase their velocity. It creates all kinds of adverse side effects, and actually the velocity measure itself means even less now, right? Other things I start to see happen is organizations do cross-team velocity comparisons. You know, hey, team A, you're not moving fast enough. Your velocity was only 20. Team B's velocity was 47. What's up with that? And of course, we've talked enough about, you know, kind of the squidginess of the measure and all of these other things that go into it. Cross-team velocity comparisons are never healthy. They don't tell you anything, and they actually create unnecessary competition within, you know, the organization. Another common one that I see with velocity especially is teams still stick with estimating in time. And we talked about this a little bit, just talking about the Sudoku puzzles and how actually, you know, estimating how long a thing is going to take how long does it take to solve a puzzle is almost impossible. And it tends, when we estimate in time, then organizations that do that have a tendency to have higher scrutiny over any variance. Right. Hey, you said this was going to take 2.5 days, and I noticed that it was 2.72 days. What's up with that? Whereas if you said this was a 3 points and it seems to have taken approximately how much 3-point stories take, we seem to be okay with it. So estimating in time leads to, you know, adverse behaviors, right? And one of my least favorites is seeing organizations that measure individual velocity. So actually looking at what does developer A's, you know, velocity look like compared to developer B's velocity on the same team? And developer A must be so much better because she delivers more points than developer B. And what you end up with there is you're actually removing any incentive for the developers on the team to help each other. If developer B happens to deliver fewer story points because she's always helping the junior developers and gets penalized for that, she will stop helping the junior developers to increase her personal velocity, which does not help the team overall.
Actually, that kind of leads us on to another portion of your book where you talk about the side effects of metrics. And I imagine that's one of them. But what would be a few other side effects?
Yeah, so when we're actually talking about some of the side effects are interesting. So here what I'm actually talking about is psychological side effects. There's a few things. There's the Hawthorne effect, there's Goodhart's law, and there's Friedman's thermostat. Hawthorne effect and Goodhart's law are probably the two most important ones. So Hawthorne effect is a whole story about a series of studies that was done for efficiency in factories at a Hawthorne facility, actually. And fundamentally what ended up happening was they discovered that it didn't seem to matter what change they made in the environment. Measurements improved. And the final conclusion was, the fact that people knew they were being measured was what caused the improvements, right? So I could increase the lighting in the room and measurements would go up. I could then decrease the lighting in the room and measurements would go up again. People knew that environment changes were being, you know, that we were looking at how environment changes affected throughput. The fact that you let people know that you're measuring something automatically changes the behavior and changes the measurement. And that's not necessarily a good thing, because if those measurements are going up, either it's artificial or something else has to give, right? If you imagine that the system is balanced to begin with, and suddenly more effort is being put towards this one thing that's being measured, then less effort must be being put towards other things that actually matter but aren't being measured. Goodhart's law, probably more important in a lot of ways. This is from economics, and Goodhart was an advisor to the Bank of England. Distillation of Goodhart's law, when you set a target for a metric, you invalidate that metric, right? It no longer means what it once did. You've changed the system, which also means that your target doesn't mean what you hoped it meant. And I think Goodhart's law is very interesting, because oftentimes when leadership sets targets for metrics, the next thing that happens is they say, well, the measurements changed, but that's because the team gamed the system. Well, let's be clear. The team did not game the system. The team operated within the system that you gamed. When you set a target, you gamed the system.
It's a weird thing. I was listening to the BBC today, and they were talking about things like Fitbits and other step monitoring devices people wear. And if you reach your 10,000, you get your little reward. But people have become obsessed with it.
Yes.
And they're gaming it too. They're putting the Fitbits on the dog. They're putting them into the washing machine, they're saying.
I had someone that I knew, I won't even say how I knew them, that in their family, they decided that they were going to do a fitness competition. And one of the family members would drop their Fitbit into the mom's purse when she would go out to run errands, and then would pick it back up. And that way they got all of their mom's steps while they sat and played video games.
Bad approach.
Yeah.
There is the concept of a variable velocity, sometimes viewed negatively. Why do you think that is?
Well, so when I want to talk about variable velocity, so there's a theory that your velocity is going to stabilize. And when it stabilizes, that's really good. And then it's going to get faster. Right. And if we read especially the early Scrum books, that's just kind of the magic that's supposed to happen. But if we're not looking at why the velocity is variable, why it's unstable, and getting to root cause, then we're focused on the wrong stuff. Right. And so I list a number of reasons in the book why velocity might actually be variable. Right? Why is that? And it could be because you've got poor story composition. And that could be anything from, some stories are really big and chunky and some stories are teeny tiny. Stories are not independently deliverable. There's any number of ways that the way that you put the stories together creates these weird bottlenecks and gluts in your flow. Dependencies on other teams or individuals can cause highly variable velocity. We actually deliver at a pretty good rate, but every time we need a database change, it takes an extra 3 weeks. Right. Most common problem that I see is actually too much work in process. We know that because we've got this iteration of 2 weeks and we've got X number of things we need to get done, we start them all and we try and work on them all. And a lot of times our thinking is, well, I know one of them is going to get paused, so it's good for me to be able to pick up something else so that I'm always busy. But being busy and being effective are not necessarily the same thing, right? And so teams that pick up too much work have a real hard time getting it all done, and that results in this velocity that, one iteration is super low, the next one it's really high, and it's just all over the place, right? And of course, things like silos in the organization or just a variety of forms of mismanagement can also lead to variable velocity. Right. And so this is one thing that's interesting about velocity in general. Right. There are other things that we can measure that help us get to root cause analysis of why is it variable. And here's the thing. If you measure those other things in order to stabilize the velocity, once the velocity is stable, you no longer need it as a metric because the other metrics that you had to use to get there actually serve your purpose better.
To come back to your book, it's called Escape Velocity, Better Metrics for Agile Teams. Mm-hmm. So what should we be measuring?
So I've got a number of things I look at, and there's a lot of stuff that we can measure, right? Two of my favorites actually are cycle time and lead time. Very simply, lead time, I tend to be the measure from, hey, wouldn't it be nice if, to, hey, ain't that nice, right? So from the moment we have the idea to the moment that it's actually in production and someone's using it, that's our lead time. And it's not always easy to measure that exactly. So we might pull those edges in a little bit, but it's basically the full chunk. Cycle time then is the amount of time it takes to do kind of each of the steps or stages. And even on Agile teams, there are still steps and stages. There tends to be some requirements gathering up front and some development that kind of happens in a concentration. And then, of course, there's the actual deployment to production, right? And each of those things takes an amount of time. And we measure those and look at them and understand them, we can start to see bottlenecks in the system. And then we can actually, that helps us to figure out where to hone in and improve process. One of the ways that I will help teams do that is using a cumulative flow diagram. And a cumulative flow diagram is really simple to do. I actually detail how to create one in the book. But what this does is gives you a very clean visual of the flow of work through the team. It lets you see where the bottlenecks are, and it lets you see the impact of those bottlenecks on other things. And if we look at the flow of work through any given system, the bottleneck is the greatest bottleneck is the only thing we need to fix, because the entire system only moves that fast. And when we fix that bottleneck, the system gets faster. Something else will become the bottleneck, and now we need to hone in on that. Cumulative flow diagrams help us see where that is and lets us know where we need to focus our efforts. So those are often what I will use. I've got a couple other things in terms of actual delivery frequency and flow efficiency, but I'd actually skip the next things in I think in priority are actually code quality, which is, interestingly enough, a thing many organizations don't measure. And I'm looking at objective measurements, right? So complexity of the code. Coverage is okay. It tells us some things, but sometimes it gets misused. But certainly looking at like the complexity of the code, adherence to idiomatic standard, those types of things, right? So we're looking at is it well composed? Is it maintainable? And then the last one that I encourage measurement of is team joy. And what I mean by this is honestly, you know, how happy are the people at work? And there's a number of ways to measure this. One of my favorites actually is, on check-in, when people are checking in their changes, their commits, they're usually going to pre-tag the commit with, their story number. And then just basically some delimiter, hyphen, or tilde, I don't care. And then a number from 0 to 5. 0, I hate this code, why do I work here? 5, this is awesome, we should open source it. What we're doing is we're asking them their opinion of the code, but it's actually a good proxy for their joy at work. And, you know, joy is kind of a foofy word, right? And why are you measuring that? Well, when in the organizations where we've done this, what we have found fairly consistently is that joy is something of a leading indicator. So the team's kind of sense of angst starts to increase. Within a couple of iterations, we will see quality go down. We will see the amount of time it takes to deliver something go up. And so if we're measuring the team's satisfaction, we have a early response. We have an early signal that we can respond to and adjust right away, or either adjust our expectations, or adjust, you know, the system itself.
To go back to your first one, where you're measuring the slowest or the worst part of your system, do you see things like DevOps being sort of the practical application of a tool to assist fixing that?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think it's interesting in a lot of organizations. So I went into an organization a number of years ago, and they basically brought us in to improve the speed of the software team, right? And to get these developers to work faster. And we looked at the full lead time, and the cycle times. What we realized was, hey, look, there's like 40 days of lead time for any given unit of work that you want done. The cycle time for development is 4 days. If we hammer on these folks, we get a 25% improvement. It goes to 3 days, which means your lead time is now 39 days, right? It's negligible. It doesn't make a difference. But it turns out that after development is complete, you've got a 6-week cycle of hardening and deployment. That's where your problem is. right? And DevOps has certainly made a huge difference in that space around automation of deployments, automation of verification, validation, plus really pushing even those responsibilities into the team, just as you know we had done with testing as a responsibility on the team and requirements definition as a responsibility on the team. Now we've got the full life cycle, and it is making a huge difference. You see teams able to move faster because they've got all the right skills.
Have you had a practical success with your Team Joy approach?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely, right? So, success in terms of I've seen, you know, I've seen organizations, especially teams, specifically where, you know, just knowing that it's being measured has automatically created kind of a morale improvement. But being able to have that as a leading indicator and being able to really like respond to it as we see it happening and have the right discussions and adjust our expectations or plans, is huge. It can honestly be. Sometimes it just leads to a very honest conversation about, it turns out that this area of the code is just really bad. We're having a practical discussion about maybe if we took a little bit of extra time and refactored some of this stuff and got it to clean, then, you know, long term, we'd have a payout. And so it's leading to better discussions.
If someone wants to buy your book now, where do they go to find it, Doc?
Yeah, it is on LeanPub, and it's fairly easy to find. It is actually leanpub.com. Whack Escape Velocity.
And then your own websites, if someone wants to follow you.
Yeah, so I am Doc on Dev everywhere, including on the web, including my website. So www.docondev.com. And that's pretty much, that's my handle for everything too. Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, blah, blah, blah. So
great. Very easy. Any final notes before we wrap up for the evening?
Certainly if people are getting the book, I am open to feedback and appreciate, you know, hearing more from them. A couple of things coming up for me, if people are interested, in October, I've got, DSM Agile coming up, which is in Des Moines. And then I am keynoting, DevUp in St. Louis, October 16, 17, 18. And then, this is exciting for me, because it's my first time to be able to do this, in late November through early December. I will be in Australia. I am speaking at, Yao, looking forward to that. I've known, Dave and some of those folks for quite a while.
So what is Yao?
So Yao is a tech conference in Australia. We will actually cover Melbourne and, Sydney and Brisbane.
Sounds like a great time to be in Australia.
Yeah, it'll be nice.
Well, Doc Norden, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Oh, thank you.
The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Dimmed Lights by Unheard Music Concepts from the album Slow.